This episode of The Drunken Odyssey is brought to you by Scribophile, an online community with thousands of serious writers working in every conceivable genre. If you're eager to improve your own work and network with others, Scribophile is for you. Scribophile has educational tutorials, exciting forums, and most importantly, the ability to exchange in-depth critiques with other writers, using a karma system that keeps the exchange fair and equal. What is most exciting to me is that Scribophile allows writers to critique novel chapters, which is not something a writer can be guaranteed to experience in an MFA program. A basic account is free and grants you all the features, but upgrading to a premium account allows you to gain access to posting numerous works at once, requires no additional karma points to enter contests and other special features for only $9 a month or $65 a year. That's a lot less than a Netflix subscription. Listeners of The Drunken Odyssey will receive a 20% discount on top of those already low rates. Check out this week's show notes for details.
Prelude to Becoming Holy. The visions begin at 6, the lime bitter in your mouth, the elegy for all you once wanted to become breaking across the water like a storm, the sight they called it. This is how a girl becomes holy. First, she becomes empty. To be a girl is to be an opening, something to be filled. So at 14, you fucked the neighborhood girls, sugar thick on your tongue, but all you are still is wet and absent, mouth open, stoned whole. Catherine, your throat flushed with mint and salt water to cure your desire for softness, the woman you knew in the dark, as if you could ever be anything more than afterwound. Catherine, at night you know, the air holds a place for girls like you. Stars are beautiful only because of their absence in the rest of the sky, because of that stretch of new emptiness. So you think you'll let the dusk turn like a rotting pear until it is as soft and as full as teeth.
Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 525 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, I talked to Bryn Rebel Henry about her exquisite latest collection of verse, Prelude. So as I continue my grading of student creative work, I don't have summers off, dear listeners, in my day job. I'm increasingly arriving at the conclusion that for many of my students, the majority of their reading life occurs on social media and not professionally published, professionally vetted works. How else to describe the derangement of punctuation? My current fixation is when students use an apostrophe not to indicate a possessive noun nor a contraction, but simply for the mere pluralization of singular nouns. I mean, who am I to insist that the sky comma isn't appropriate to prove that the plural noun is indeed plural? And since plural nouns require apostrophes, possessive nouns then somehow must not require them, otherwise there would be too many apostrophes, right? In books news this week, last Thursday I attended a book launch by my friend Rochelle Hurt at the Kerouac Project of Orlando. The house was packed to hear passages from The J-Girls. There will be an interview with Rochelle coming soon to this podcast. I can also report that Shakespeare & Company has a podcast called Friends of Shakespeare & Company Read Ulysses by James Joyce. A recent episode features Greg Proops and Jennifer Kanaga reading 19 pages from the Q&A chapter, known as the Ithaca section. Greg and Jennifer did a fab job. It's a sublimely goofy act of meditation. I'll post a link to that episode of Friends of Shakespeare and Company Read Ulysses by James Joyce in this week's show notes. Well, this week, besides, you know, keeping up with a day job, I've written 2 pages of a screenplay up until when I caught some sort of bug. So far, it's not COVID, according to a test. I'll take a new test in the morning. So how is your writing going, dear listeners? Do write in and let me know. Encourage me or send me questions and whatnot. The address is thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com. All right, let's talk to Bryn.
And now, the interview of the day.
Bryn Rebel Henry is the author of the award-winning poetry collection, Autobiography of a Wound, and the award-winning YA novel, Orpheus Girl. Her latest book is Prelude, a series of poems imagined in the voice of St. Catherine of Siena, whose twin sister died not long after birth and whose older sister, Bonaventura, died in childbirth. Catherine experienced visions that drew her deep into religious devotion and away from the procreative mandates of the secular lives of women in the Middle Ages. The perspective of the book, quote, addresses the historical erasure of gay women's lives, juxtaposing details from her girlhood with the terrain of the lesbian body as it relates to desire and violence, from the author's introduction. Also, the mummified head of St. Catherine is a relic still on display to this very day. My great pleasure to welcome Bryn Rebel Henry to the show. Thank you so much for taking some time out of my afternoon and your evening to talk to me.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
When I ask you to select a poem to read, I do especially love poetry volumes that really cling together, in which all the poems, not only are they solid on their own, but they build to a bigger story. And this is a very specific project that is simultaneously narrative and not. Like, it's very much lyrical, emotional poems about sexuality and identity and, in some sense, you know, a budding spirituality. But I found it very difficult to say, okay, if I had to pick one poem that kind of gives a sense of what the mission of this book is, I found myself really challenged to, like, definitively say, like, no, this would be a great one. And I like to drink and I can be pretty flip about things. And yet with this one, I couldn't find a way to easily pick one. And I love the book very much. So I think it's a testament to just the way that you have constructed the book as a whole. So can you talk a little bit about how this very specific and particular project came your way?
Right. And thank you. Yeah, well, I wanted the book to reconstruct her girlhood. And so the way that I thought of each poem was that each had to fit together because I thought of it as occupying a fleeting space of time. And I think that the way socially that we think of girlhood is, I think we think of it as three things. I think we think of it as something that's a deficit. I think we think of the experience of girlhood as something where something is taken from you, whether that's childhood or innocence or the way that you interact in the world physically changes. And I also think that we think of girlhood as a kind of dual loss because it's also so fleeting that it's something that one is meant to be nostalgic for or where it's leaving you as you're inhabiting it. And so this is sort of the idea behind how I constructed the book and how I wanted each poem to function and fit into the next.
And when girls are no longer, they lose virginity, which is almost like, I mean, it's a legal matter, you know, especially in the Middle Ages. And just watching what had to seem like a nightmare of just childbirth and child rearing that could be never ending, you know, like if you weren't sure you were up for it, had to seem like a death sentence or a prison sentence or something that dire.
Right. And it's interesting because I think you can see this reflected in some of her letters as well, and in perhaps her later actions and the way in which she related to her, what she felt was a spiritual calling to live a life as a nun, in which she, you know, claimed to be married to Jesus and she never had children. And yeah, I mean, I think that especially I've been thinking about this sort of death sentence a lot with what's happening in the US right now with Roe v. Wade. I think there's this continuous, obvious idea of the need to control women's bodies, to control motherhood, to control procreation. So, yeah.
So in the case of Catherine, I'm not that familiar with her. Is it a certainty that she was a lesbian, or is this a case where, of course, talking about death sentences, like if you were queer in any way, that could be a death sentence unless you were a very well-protected and private aristocrat, perhaps. Mm-hmm. So, and also male, probably. But throughout history, we have all of these bachelors, unmarried people who, like, we just don't talk about it. And sometimes we just have to presume, you know, that there was a high likelihood that people who never had a public romantic life, I'm sure like a very small percentage of them maybe were asexual, which also doesn't mean they didn't have a romantic life, but probably most of the active people who just never had public romantic life were in fact closeted.
Right. No, this is true. And this is very much, for the record, very much the assumption of kind of conflating lesbianism and Catherine Siena's experience in letters. Yeah, it was something I was thinking of a lot when I was originally reading her letters for academic research. Oh, it must have been 5 years ago. And the way that she interacted with women, the way she spoke of women and her story, and this sort of, I think you can easily intuit or sense this, ways in which she saw childbirth devastate and lost so many people to it. And her decision when it was her time to be married to her sister's widower after her sister died giving birth to have her first vision publicly. And I think for this reason, it was very much a conflation of things. But yeah, I think that often these lives are assumed, or what we can try to piece together of them is incomplete. And, you know, of course, there's also the classic historical, you know, two women who were roommates who never married.
Yes.
So, yeah, this is how I think it's often left in history.
Yeah, literally centuries before Gertrude and Alice. Yeah, we just have to make certain assumptions. So the verse in this collection is really beautiful, and I kind of admire the way that you have created a voice meant to inhabit this spot in history that, I don't know, it's not showy in the way that it tries to, you know, create a sense of this person's life. I guess, like, there's the flourish of, okay, there's the occasional Italian word, like, reminding us, all right, this is very Italian. This isn't, this isn't Cleveland, even though, because the voice is also so immediate, it feels like it could be almost anywhere, anytime, throughout much of it until we get into some of the very specific details. And even though the Middle Ages were horrible, your comparison to, yeah, a post Roe v. Wade America is not completely wrong either, that, you know, like it's kind of this continuum of either misogyny or stupidity, probably both. depending on which actual lawmakers and justices we're talking about and the people putting these structures in place. And so I was just very touched by that, how, and I mean, I think of historical films and sometimes they just throw like Hollywood actors in there. And so you have British people and Americans that are somehow supposed to be playing like one race of people without any sense of, okay, like, what are they pretending to do? Like everybody, even if it's wrong, everybody has to be pretending to be doing something similar. And that was a decision I believe you had to make in this book, like what language would match your vision of how to tell this story in a poetic way. So can you talk a little bit about those decisions that you made, probably discovered along the way, as to how to determine a lexicon for Catherine and her stories?
Right. Thank you. And yeah, one of the things that I really thought of when I was starting the book, and I approached it in two ways. One, the tone, the voice, the language used, any deciding, you know, if there were anachronisms, what anachronisms should there be, and the scope, but also the physical way that the poems occupy the page was very intentional, because I was thinking of, I think I wanted there to be this sense of restraint from someone who saw this life of great restraint, of starvation, spent physically diminishing herself in order to be seen as holy or to have seen as having accomplished a sort of inhuman task, basically. Which
or,
is how,
or not being a great candidate for childbearing if you're just going to starve yourself. Sorry.
Yeah. No, I mean, this too, right? And yeah, the way in which space took up so much of her life, the physical space of her body, the space she was trying to actively diminish, the way that she saw its existence in the world. And so this was why I tried to have a sense of restraint in the poems, of this kind of, not muted, but a way of kind of stilting or of keeping things concise in such a way was very much intentional for this reason. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, these thoughts, a lot of which are almost unforgivable, even as she's sort of off voicing self-recrimination, like, you know, I shouldn't want these things. Oh, here's more of my introduction that I didn't read. But kind of on on this topic. You know, in the poem Absolvement, there's the line, "The hurt was a thing we swallowed until it corroded."
Right.
That the judgment of her family or everybody, possibly, just kind of made inhabiting a body almost impossible.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that shame is something that has become so intertwined with sexuality, with experience, with identity, that it was something that I thought a lot about, her experience with shame in these poems and how it would be informed and intertwined in this way by her environment, basically.
And there, you know, partly I have to wonder, like, if there was even any language around that, like, today you just Google anything and it's like, well, okay, wasn't ready for that, but okay, now everybody knows. Whereas in the Middle Ages, while I certainly don't have that naive perspective of things were simpler back then or anything like that, you know, I do wonder, you know, for a child trying to negotiate these things, like, she knows what her desires kind of are and she knows what the consequences are of having them. But it seems like there's also just the chaos of being in the world, and her cosmology is sometimes beautiful, even in its nihilism. Like, I think the book eventually arrives at this arc that is really beautiful and affirmative, but there's just there's so much wrestling with doubt and guilt and shame and uncertainty overall, I think, even as the reality of the body is becoming more and more real, the older she becomes, that, all right, here's the point when I ask the question, and I think I just used up some oxygen, maybe I didn't arrive there. It seems to me like her confusion has a lot to do with it, and I think the short poems, or when you have a longer poem, you basically have the habit of breaking it into sections, each section is really small, so that even though the subject matter is really heavy, the touch is very light, so that, you know, you meet the reader very much halfway in being able to inhabit the subject matter of these poems. And again, it's kind of delightful. It's almost imaginatively Proustian in that, like, I'm responding to memories that I never had, but I just feel like her memories are somehow connected to my memories because it feels old and new at the same time.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the idea sort of was, yeah, quasi-nihilism, right, to leading to affirmation and to acceptance. And yeah, I think in a lot of ways I wanted the book and the poems in the book, and some, yeah, in a lot of ways it was an ode of sorts to impermanence, to the impermanence of girlhood, to the impermanence of experience of the body, which was different things that I was thinking of a lot. And I also think that a lot of Catherine's letters, which I read when I was researching, so much of them were grappling with mortality, with ideas around mortality, either praising it as something to look forward to, which is a little bit where maybe the sort of more morbid aspects of the poems come in, sort of trying to capture that essence or the dread of mortality. And this is something I was thinking of a lot. So in many ways, I wanted it to be about impermanence, but I also wanted to, again, sort of structure the poems around the fact that this is someone who has spent much of her life diminishing herself. And so the small fragments, or having multiple fragments on a page, or having lines that then just lead to a blank line on the page, was very intentional because I wanted the silences or the absences on the page to also function as a part of the poem, basically.
Literal erasures.
Yeah, exactly.
With a blank line, like Mad Libs, and the reader has to think about what goes in that line.
Right, yeah, sort of self-censorship or self-removal, basically, was how I was thinking of it.
And without that blank line, if it was just white space, I might go, oh, now it's just getting really abstract, and oh, I'm floating. And so I think that was like a very good technical choice, is to, no, there's a blank there. You can't see what's in there, but that something should definitely be there. And it's not. I also think of how, you know, almost in a body horror way, Catherine seems terrified of the substances that are going into her body. You know, there's the descriptions of like having an oily mouth, or like having scuzzy teeth, and just like everything that goes in seems to taint the body. And, you know, like part of me is wondering, oily mouth, like, okay, what was for dinner? And I realized, like, it's not always food that is necessarily being described in terms of, you know, like the sensations, but that felt so vivid to me, this almost body horror that she has, even as she acknowledges, I don't know, I find the way that you've described this, the shame is maybe so internalized that, like, she's not really expressing moral judgments against herself necessarily. Not much of the time. It's more just, this is gross, and this brings me pleasure, even though I feel like instead of being the light of a star, I'm kind of the black space in between all the stars and things like that.
Yeah, no, I think body horror is a great way to describe it. In terms of a lot of the depictions, one with the teeth, she had a lot of issues with her teeth later in life. And most people, this is obviously pre-dentistry, pre-floss, pre-mouthwash. So this is quite common, but she in particular had some great difficulties with her teeth. And yeah, I also was thinking of sort of the ritual of the body, the ritual of trying to cleanse the body, the ritual of being unable to keep the body clean in her case and in this time period. And also, yeah, the rituals of purging, of trying to drink water with citrus or having oil on her mouth to cleanse her teeth was very much part of kind of trying to tie into the landscape that I wanted the poems to inhabit, but also thinking of physical ritual and meaning.
And also just the orality of the mouth. Okay, that just sounded so horribly academic. Like, okay, the PhD is coming out. The orality of the and then just more gobbledygook comes out. But, you know, considering all the fasting she did and, like, just the teeth are the tools of the mouth that you eat with, and just kind of being suspicious and not feeling great about that, like, I imagine that also just ties into the sense of how difficult it is to have any control over one's body or over oneself.
Right,
if you're a woman in medieval Italy. I mean, maybe a woman at any time, anywhere, outside of, I don't know, an all-women's colony or something, but especially then.
Yeah, no, exactly.
So how did the subject first appear to you?
It appeared in a poem in my second poetry book, Autobiography of a Wound, that was talking about saints, because this book had utilized the collection of fertility figures at the Met. And in researching this, basically, I had come across and sort of ended up, as you know, you often do, in sort of a wild research flurry of the practices of female medieval saints, which was largely centered around diminishing the body or punishing the body. And I thought this was really interesting. And I was basically doing research into this as a result, and had written a few more abstract poems, and I came upon her letters, and I was just really taken by them in this idea and this sort of voice and story. And so I then researched for probably 2 or 3 years while I was working on the book, and the book took me, I think, 2.5 years to finish. And so it sort of came about in this way.
So when you came across her story, was there an aha moment, like, oh, I could work with this? Like, she's my people?
I think I wasn't sure what the scope of the book should be. I knew I wanted to write poems that somehow inhabited a persona of this saint, and that I wanted to add a lesbian lens to an aspect of this trajectory into sainthood, basically. But it took me a while to figure out and decide if the scope of that, would it be her whole life? Would it be her girlhood? And I had basically two drafts, one in which it was just her life in general. And I realized that that wasn't quite right, and that it needed to be about girlhood and her. It had two drafts, one that was just her life and one that was her life. And I realized that it needed to be about her girlhood, and that it needed to be the arc of girlhood, basically. And so over the course of a year, I rewrote it and shifted it in this way.
Yeah. So her adulthood, she was actually a pretty powerful person and worked with one of the popes and was kind of, you know, a major historical figure in her own right. And she had a lot of, I believe, spiritual writings. So it seems like as an adult, she had a lot to say for herself. So what was it like when you tried to write her adulthood part, and what proved unsatisfying for you?
That's an interesting question. I would say what was unsatisfying was that it was because I was thinking of writing of a scope of impermanence. And it was also, many of the poems are in response to her sister's death when she's a teenager. And that is really in many ways what I think the book needed to be about. And so trying to shift it into her adulthood, it sort of lost the structure or the arc I wanted to have. And it instead became this sort of lengthy, baggy book of poems about desire and the body and the ways that the body, like you said, body horror, the horror of the body, the horror of having a body. And it wasn't the book that I was trying to write, and it wasn't the arc that I wanted the book to have or the story I was necessarily thinking of. And this is what proved to be unsatisfying.
So the narrative arc.
Yes.
And also in this light, it seems like the book is itself kind of a giant poem. And that at the very end, there is this breathtaking turn that I don't want to rob the audience of when they get a hold of this book. So let's talk about her sister, because, yeah, her sister dies in childbirth. And in the Middle Ages, parents were on the financial hook for their daughters.
Yes.
And so the idea was they needed to marry their daughters off to class-appropriate families, hopefully, in which their daughters would be cared for, although mileage on that may vary depending on which family we're talking about, and also just what were the options. And this was also before romantic marriage was a common idea. Like, there was probably more considered a crazy idea at the time. But on the other hand, yeah, if you're a young teenage girl and your sister just died and your parents go, "You're next, go." Like, that also has to seem like something not just a matter of perpetuating family wealth, but also, yeah, at the expense of probably dying young.
Right. And also of stepping into the sister's life, because the idea was that she would marry the sister's widower. And so she would marry the man that her sister had been married to.
Which, yeah, it seems like it's tiptoeing up to, I don't know, some incest line. Like, I have a hard time exactly saying why I feel a little creeped out or a lot creeped out by the idea of like, no, you should just want to be with him. Like, what? Does he have a brother at least? Does it have to be him?
Yeah, being swapped in, right, was the idea, this sort of fear of being swapped into your sister's life who just died in this way. And, you know, the idea that she probably would likely potentially die in this way or lose children in this way too. So this sort of inevitable loss.
And I have to think, on a psychological level, part of the message being conveyed is you are interchangeable. You're just a female body. You don't have an identity that's worth taking into consideration other than as a viable female body. Now go procreate so that they could pay for you and we don't have to pay for you, even though you're probably going to die giving birth this time or the next time, or, wow, if you're great, like maybe many, many pregnancies after. Medieval medicine is, wow. So
yeah, I imagine it would feel like that.
So what is it like to take as much time as you've taken to try and serve this young woman's voice rather than using your own voice? I realize your own voice probably slips in here and there, because if you can't identify with her, like, it'd probably be really hard. But on the other hand, you know, the sustained effort of this, the conceit is, it works extraordinarily. And so that took discipline. So what was it like to be so disciplined for so long and trying to serve her story more than maybe what you wanted to say?
It's a great question. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that inevitably some of my voice slipped in, as I think it often does. And it was really different than the process for my other poetry books. This was much longer. It required more drafts. I think my others sort of, it felt like it was sort of the book just kind of fit all of a sudden and I knew where it was and I went forward with it. But this one was definitely more drawn out, and I don't want to say painful, but a little bit painful process of sort of figuring out what it was meant to be, how to put it together. There was also a major research component, because I was reading her letters, and I also tried to translate some of her letters from the original Italian, which was in sort of an antiquated dialect. So this was also quite complicated while I was doing the research. And so it was really sort of a two-part project. It was research and then the poetry itself. And it was completely different than my other process for Autobiography of a Wound or my first poetry collection. I hope that answers the question.
And what was the experience of reading those letters like? As I said, I only know the roughest outlines of her life. So you could be proud that, yeah, I mostly know about her through your writing.
Yeah.
But her letters or journals, like, we have to assume these were not meant for public consumption. Like, if you're an official male writer, I forget exactly when this habit started, but the assumption was, no, your letters would be collected because you're a famous writer, and those letters themselves become a literary document. The only way a woman could accomplish the same thing was if everyone thought she was a man. That would have been true until maybe the 19th century, maybe. So unlike her writings later in life, these were more private writing. So can you tell me a little bit about that reading experience?
It was really interesting. So a lot of the letters often were spiritual or political advising, and some of them were, say, to the wives of various men in politics or who were important in this time. Some were to other religious leaders, so it was really quite varied. But there was a sense of, I'm trying to think of, I would best encapsulate it by saying there's a sense of gleeful religious mania at points, and this kind of just chaotic excitement. And in others, there's this sort of despondence. And I was really struck by that, these sort of two polar extremes that she often would very quickly fly to between the letters to different figures. But there was also this great sort of lyricism and the sense of rapture and of recitation almost in them, like religious recitation, that I was just really touched by at points.
So this is published by University of Pittsburgh Press, and this is one of those cases where I feel like as an art object, it just felt good to hold it in my hand. Hunter S. Thompson once referred to a Kitty Kelly biography, and he goes, I felt cheap just holding this book in my hand. And for some reason that stuck in my mind, but I apply the opposite case of there are certain books where just holding it in my hand, I feel excited. And I wonder if you could talk about working with the press and also the cover artwork and just what you think of the whole package. It kind of looks pagan, like it's gorgeous and colorful, but it also looks like maybe it's very early Christian, but maybe it's pagan, and it looks, of course, it might also be a very modern take on medieval pagan or, all right, that's right. Not even a thing. But, and that's the problem when I ask questions, is I just go on and forget to drop the question mark in and let someone. So can you tell me a little bit about working with U of Pittsburgh Press and also the finished product and how it looks?
Yes. I can't say enough good things about the University of Pittsburgh Press or about the cover artist. She also designed Autobiography of a Wound, and her work is just brilliant. And I love to hold both books because they're just stunning. And I also think that all of her covers just perfectly encapsulate what the book is or what you would want the book to be. And so, yeah, I was so excited when I got this cover art. I actually got it the day before I got on the plane to move to Slovenia. I'm here currently for a fellowship. And so I was, at the gate at the airport in Boston before I have to turn my American phone off, sending emails about it because I was just so excited. And I really love working with everyone at this publisher. It's really just, I can't speak highly enough of them. So
Karen Constance is the artist. So did you get a say in it, or is it more they produce the art and then you get to marvel at how great it looks? But you were probably anxious then until then.
I wasn't, because also Melissa Diaz-Mandeli does the design as well. And she'd worked with Autobiography of a Wound. She did the design for the cover. And so I knew it was going to be beautiful. I think a design questionnaire where I had some general ideas of what I would want it to encapsulate, or I wanted there to be the sense of like guilt or sort of iconography. So I think this was the very sort of loose notes that I gave.
Yeah, no, it almost looks like caveman Edenic, something or other. And, the figure on the cover seems to be wearing a necklace of very large teeth.
Yeah, I love that detail. I was really happy about that.
And there's kind of this corona around the head that is pretty exquisite.
Like an abstracted halo.
Was there an editor who helped work on the final version of the book, or was it mostly, yep, we got it, thanks?
Yes, there was. Both times that I published the book, I worked with Ed O'Chester, and there's other editors, you know, that you work with when you're copy editing and doing the other various things that happen before, you know, a book arrives in the world, basically.
And so what were some of the things that got massaged or changed in that process?
Actually, I don't think there were any major changes. I don't think there was any major change to the structure or tone of the book, I wouldn't say.
Okay.
You know, it was more just, you know, honing and fixing and just the sort of small alterations that you make to get a book ready to sort of be in its final form and that they're really brilliant at.
Well, at working on this project for so long, did you have any feedback on it before then? I find that sometimes when I'm looking on a long project and I forget to show anybody, or I'm like, well, I'll show them when like more of the whole is ready, and I just keep putting that off, even though the difference between like a really great draft and a not especially good draft might be five words that are just messing everything up. I find, you know, sometimes it's really helpful. So did you have readers before then give you any feedback that was helpful?
Yeah, I'm very lucky to have sort of a variety of people in my life in different capacities who usually, you know, get the late night email with the draft of the manuscript I'm working on. And yeah, I'm also very lucky to get a lot of different notes or feedback from. And so I think that my friends likely were very much subjected to different iterations of the book as I was figuring out the scope and what it was meant to be, basically. Because I think over the course of those years that I worked on it, I think there were maybe three drafts before I got to the final one. And so I think with all three drafts, they had a few different readers basically for each one. I hope that answers the question.
Yeah. And did you read any of this work while you were working on it? I mean, in public?
Sorry, do you mean at readings? Or?
Yes.
Okay, yes. Sorry. I did, yeah. I had actually some early poems of it were translated in Slovenian, and I read them at a literary festival, the Days of Poetry and Wine here. And I think I also read from it at Juniper Young Writers at UMass in 2018. So there were some early drafts or different drafts of the poems that I kind of read in the world before the book itself was fully together, fully done. And I was figuring it out. And this was also really helpful too, I think, to see the way that other people respond to the work, because I think so much of it exists within your head. And so much of it is, you know, after a day of writing, you're kind of learning how to be human again, because you're so sort of abstracted. And so to actually kind of, interact with the poems physically with people was really important, I think, for me, for my process. And the same for it with autobiography as well. My other poetry collection, it was the same. So
I think of the lead player in Tom Stoppard's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, who says, "We are actors, we are the opposite of people."
Yeah, exactly.
When it comes to readings, I'm of two minds. One, it's a great way to find out what works and what doesn't work, like in a visceral way, but also there's the danger of trying to be too entertaining, or like sometimes things work on the page better than they actually work in a public setting. And so I'm of the mind that I would rather fail and be too entertaining than not entertaining enough or grab my audience enough, like in an immediate visceral way. But I also worry about that becoming compulsive behavior and just thoughtlessly like going for whatever I know is going to work on an audience of my friends who are drinking. And so I think those are some of the things that I weigh when I read work in public. What are your experiences thinking about, you know, revision and, you know, what you've written? Because once you read it out loud, it's no longer just in your head. And you do kind of have the glory and maybe the misery of knowing right away just how it's working in an environment. And again, shorter poems make it much easier for people to latch on. But what is your experience like thinking about how to approach revision based on things you might learn or sense while giving a public reading?
Right. Actually, sometimes I edit the poem while I'm reading it out loud, because as you're reading out, I'll have the homework with the rhythm. So then I, you know, cut it from the poem, and later I go home and I type the change into my Word document. So sometimes it's a little bit sort of happening during the reading, and if I think something works particularly well out loud versus on the page, I'll make a note and I'll either read it that way out loud and keep it the way it is on the page, or I'll make the change to the poem itself. And I think this is, for me, is important. I think the way that things function when they're spoken to is really important to me, to the book. So everything has to be able to sort of be read and to have an intonation. And so this is why it's so important to the process for me, basically.
To make sure it's, even though it's using all of the art of poetry, it sounds conversational. Even when, if I had to say exactly what does she mean, I might struggle to come up with an easy answer, because it's not simply conversational, but the nature of the persona is these poems, while confessional, are conversational while the beauty kind of explodes out of it.
Thank you.
So do you teach poetry?
No, I don't.
Ah, okay. So what's your affiliation with UMass?
I was just a reader there at Juniper Young Writers has readers who give poetry readings. So this is, I was just giving a reading.
Okay. So one of the things that I'm interested in, this is me sharing notes. So I'm a fiction writer. Mm-hmm. Like you, I'm a fiction writer, and I write poems, and I find that I'm able to write poems when I can't work on longer things. And, you know, sometimes my ability to write a poem, even if it's not even a great poem, not a bad poem, just like almost any poem, can kind of make me feel like I'm civilized or not dying or not... just, you know, like waiting for my life to be over while I do all the things I would rather not do. And sometimes like poetry just infiltrates my mind. So this project took a while, and I imagine you worked on lots of things in that time and not just these poems. So I wonder if you might talk a little bit about writing in different genres and maybe keeping multiple projects open, and how that helps you as a writer.
I can. Yeah. I think it's funny sometimes. I think it's easy to get overwhelmed by the clutter of daily life, right? You know, you have to eat, you have to get groceries, you hypothetically have to do laundry and, you know, keep your living space moderately clean and work and, you know, yeah, the clutter of life that takes you away from writing. The way that I usually try to balance my projects is because most of my work is so research oriented. And so usually I'll spend a significant amount of time researching, outlining, reading through the research, taking notes, compiling, often before I'm fully writing something. So this sort of allows me to have spaces between my work. So I'm usually working on a novel or researching a novel. And then I'm usually writing poems while I'm researching a novel. And this sort of, the way that I look at it is kind of also having books that are in conversation with each other in a way. And so if I am writing, you know, one thing, I think of it as connecting to another. And so I think of Prelude as connecting to a novel I was working on while I was working on this that isn't published yet. But kind of trying to find a dialogue between the work is what allows me to balance it, and what allows me to sort of shift between projects and research and try to sort of connect it so it feels like they're both feeding each other in some way. I hope that answers the question.
No, it absolutely does. And so if one area just feels dry or too frustrating, you can pivot.
Yeah, exactly.
To me, there's something about the mystery of writing in that ultimately, I think we strive to be half surprised by everything we write.
Yeah.
And that if what we write has, if it doesn't have it like 25% surprises, then it's just like, okay, yeah, I can walk in place. I can chew stale gum. I can do all of that, but that's not why I'm here. And in that drive to try and half surprise ourselves by exploring and, you know, new ideas and pushing ideas to breaking points to figure out where that breaking point is and, you know, what it is that we believe and what we want to say and who we want to be and what we want the world to be like for ourselves and the people we love. There's always the risk that in trying to say something new, it's just going to be dumb and awful, which sometimes for me it is. I can't make any claims for you, but I get a thrill myself writing, knowing that what I write might be terrible and taking that risk anyway, because there's no way you can find that surprise without taking that risk of, okay, that was just awful and I hope I don't believe that. Or, you know, I think of the frustrations you were describing trying to write about Catherine's adulthood and finding that it was so past the arc of the thing that you valued that it, you know, like, even though I'm sure it's an important part of her life, like, it's the part that is the history part, that it didn't help tell your story. So to me, facing, I mean, I guess it's just the anxiety of the blank page, and everyone's, you know, a lot of writers are just worried about that blank page. And I think, let me embarrass myself. I'm the only one here. I don't have to show it if I don't think anything good came out of it. Do you share that sense of fun at risking personal embarrassment in order to find something that excites you as a writer?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what this says about me as a human being, but I'm not really prone to embarrassment. And so I think for me, for better or for worse, that's not so much the concern that I have. But I do think that my writing process is largely a very anxiety-filled one. And it's one of, you never know, right, if something is going to translate. If there's this also, I think, often for me anyway, a sense of alchemy to books where there's this sort of unknown quantity that you can't really explain how you pulled something together, how you understood something, and you just hope that it happens again. And that, you know, it was not this sort of one-time sense of cohesion, I would say.
Cosmic right. Accident, yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I often think of it kind of as these sort of long periods of uncertainty of returning to something every day without the uncertainty that it will work, that it will become a book, that it will function or be what you want it to. And I think you have to sort of abandon yourself to that uncertainty and just exist in these liminal periods of making a book and not what it will be, if it will work, if it will be good, if you'll finish it. And just kind of, yeah, for me, accepting that is a big part of it.
That's the show for this week. I would like to thank Bryn Rebel Henry, Chloe Wirtz, Chelsea Alice for editing this episode, and of course, our sponsor, Scribblefile. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including The Perfect Life with Dr. Perfect, Comics Are Trying to Break Your Heart with Drew Barth, and of course, The Curator of Schlock by Jeff Schuster. If you enjoyed this episode, please do spread the word. Share the link on social media. Talk to passenger pigeons. And so forth. All right, gang. Until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Yes. Yes. Yes, 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 yes. John. Pass me the bottle.
A while back, John King endowed the Museum of Schlock and tasked me, Jeff Schuster, with curating the bugger. Each week I curate one more entry into this proud genre of film. I think. Truth is, I'm really not sure what schlock is, but my writing about it is sublime. Read it every Friday at thedrunkenodyssey.com.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.